Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Women tend to want to be perfect candidates for anything before they will apply. Now, as I get asked by a lot of females, you know, sort of for counsel, should I apply for this? Should I do this? My answer is always, you know, just give it a shot.
Welcome to Imposters, a podcast from The Telegraph. Have you ever had that creeping feeling that you don't belong somewhere or that you don't deserve your success, even though you know deep down that's not true? Yeah, me too. I'm Claire Cohen, The Telegraph's women's editor and co-founder of our Women Mean Business initiative. In this podcast, we square up to imposter syndrome and demand to know what its deal is. In each episode, I talk to a woman who is out there carving a successful career in a challenging industry. Whether that's food or film, fashion, or even flying to the moon. I want to know if they've ever experienced imposter syndrome. If so, what convinced them to keep going anyway? If not, what's their secret? So without further ado, let's meet this week's imposter. Today, I'll be speaking to a woman who hasn't so much broken the glass ceiling as smashed through the Earth's atmosphere. As NASA's first female chief flight director, she's responsible for everything from missions to the International Space Station to putting the first woman on the moon in 2024. I can't even begin to imagine what it must be like to have that sort of responsibility. So let's find out. Welcome to Imposters, Holly Ridings. So Holly, how do you go about explaining your job to other people?
Yeah, that's a really good question. How to explain being the chief flight director, right? Because it has such a span, you know, as you mentioned in your introduction. You know, the simplest answer is I'm responsible for all of NASA's human spaceflight operations. We've got the International Space Station. It flies, you know, 365 days a year, people always living on it. We have our commercial crew program, right, where we've partnered with several companies to take our crew to and from the space station. And then, of course, Artemis, where we're going to go, you know, back to the moon, the first woman and the next man. And so really, you know, I'm responsible for making sure all of those missions get planned, you know, people are trained, and then we fly and execute them in a successful way that keeps our crew safe.
I love how matter of fact about that you are, like, just reeling them off. Oh, yeah, just, you know, responsible for the International Space Station, sending people to the moon. I love how second nature that is to you. And it just sounds so fantastical and unimaginable to me and probably to our listeners. So let's talk a bit about Artemis, which you just mentioned, which means you will be directing the next moon landing from Mission Control in Houston, Texas in 2024. You've never led a team that's gone to the moon. How do you know you can?
Yeah, so we actually talk about that a lot, you know, with our team here. You know, there's kind of two ways to do leadership, right? There's the way where you've done the thing and then people come after you and you have all this, you know, knowledge and wisdom and can tell them exactly, you know, what to look for and what to think about. And then there's, you know, the leadership where, you know, you're in charge of a team, but you're all doing a new thing, right? And so for our generation of space explorers, you know, going to the moon is new, right? There are people that came before us that did that. We still have the opportunity to talk to them. And so that's really the first thing you do is you look for people who have knowledge. So we're very lucky in the flight director office and also, you know, our crew office here at NASA that we have access to just some of those amazing people, you know, that got us to the moon, you know, the first time. And, you know, we try to learn from them. We talk a lot to them about, you know, what we call lessons learned. That's a term we use at NASA a lot, you know, the things you learn from doing something. And then really you have to learn how to sort of translate your experiences. And by that, I mean, okay, well, we lead missions that go to the International Space Station, but the things that we learn from doing that, how is that applicable? You may be going farther away from Earth. You know, your communication may be a little different, but how do you take what you've learned in that one environment and understand its applicability to the other environment? And that, you know, that takes some experience and some thought, but that's really kind of the other thing that we focus on. And then maybe the third thing for kind of leading a team to do something that you've not done is really just, you've got to be open-minded and expect, you know, sort of expect the unknown. You don't know all the answers, right? Because you've never done it before. And so, you know, that's really a mindset for how you approach problem solving.
That's interesting what you said about leadership, actually, because I've read that you've said before that you're not always the best qualified person in the room, but you're the person in charge. I mean, not everyone can handle that, kind of being a leader of people who, in some respects, might have more expertise than you. How do you handle that? Is that something that might give you imposter syndrome?
I think it's a thing you learn. Like when you start out young, I think maybe you do feel a little bit like an imposter, right? You know, you're coming up through the ranks and now all of a sudden you've been, you know, elevated to maybe not a flight director, but a leadership position where, you know, you have in spaceflight, you have a lot of subject matter experts, right? You know, you have a person who knows about power and a person who knows about life support and a person who knows about communication systems. And so very rarely does any one person know the details of all of those systems. And so in the beginning, when you start out as an expert in a single area and then you move from, you know, that role to a leadership role of any kind, it is very disorienting. And so imposter syndrome, you know, when you say that, I always think the word imposter to me almost means like I don't deserve to be here. And I've never really had that thought, like I don't deserve to be here. But I have, when I was younger, certainly had the thought like, okay, I'm here. How do I handle this? You know, right? Like what do I do? I'm not quite sure what to do. Like, cause you have to develop all these skills. Like, okay, this room of people is looking at me and I need to figure out how to, you know, help us go in the right direction. So depending on how you use the word imposter, you know, that is certainly a disconcerting moment. Over time, you learn how to ask really good questions. And those apply anywhere you go, no matter what your knowledge base is. You can ask really good questions. You build up your experience and you can draw from, you know, those examples. And you become less afraid about people seeing that you don't know things. And you become less afraid about making mistakes in front of people.
So when you're speaking to the people who were responsible for the first moon landing, what is the most unexpected or surprising thing they've told you or piece of advice they've given you?
I would tell you that it probably came from Chris Kraft, who was the very first chief flight director, really the very first flight director at NASA. His name is, you know, on the building at Mission Control here at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. And he gave it to me in sort of this indirect way. I said, you know, Dr. Kraft, what advice can you give me? And he said, there's more than one way to get to Spring, Texas. Well, Spring, Texas is a city sort of north of Houston. And, you know, I'm thinking to myself, how's that applicable to flying to the moon, right? But really, after some more discussion and thinking about it, what he meant is that there's really more than one way to solve a problem. If you get locked into what you think is the answer, especially in an environment where you've not ever experienced it, then you're really sort of discounting a lot of the creativity, a lot of, you know, what your team will bring and the ingenuity that comes from having that sort of open-minded growth mindset.
I feel like that there's more than one way to solve a problem is great advice, whether you're working at NASA, sending people to the moon or whatever job you're doing. But when you're tasked with a project like the type you work on, which have, frankly, the eyes of the world on them, how do you tackle self-doubt or how do you stop yourself experiencing something like imposter syndrome?
So at NASA, we do a lot of what we call contingency planning. Like, think of all the really bad things that can happen, and then think about what you're going to do about it ahead of time. And I think that helps you, you know, both from a personal standpoint, right, where you have to really individually be prepared to handle really, really stressful situations. And it helps you from a technical standpoint, where you've considered the worst thing that can happen, how you would handle it. And then you have that sort of thought and that body of information to draw from when you get into a situation that is really challenging. Now, those situations don't usually look exactly like what you thought of ahead of time, right? So that's kind of the trick. You can't get locked in. Okay, I thought of these five really bad things. I'm going to see one of those things exactly. But what it does is it trains you, right? Again, both personally to handle the stress and technically to be able to look for a solution in those really tough moments. We do a lot of training of those really bad days. You know, so if you're talking about going to the moon, you know, you could get halfway out there and something could go wrong with your spacecraft and you'd have to turn around and come home, right? And that's called an abort scenario. Abort is, you know, you're not going to make it to your destination. And so what do those aborts look like? You know, how do you get home from different points in the mission in a way that is, you know, safe and successful for your crew? So we spend a lot of time talking about those contingencies and thinking about them personally and training for them as a team.
How do you then personally handle the stress? I mean, do you wake up at 4 a.m. in the morning thinking about one of those worst case scenarios?
So I try not to wake up at 4 in the morning because I really like sleep. So I'm a sleeper. You know, some of those people who can sleep like 3-4 hours a night and be okay. I'm not one of those people. But, you know, so sometimes you do. I'd say for the most part, you know, you don't. You go to bed, you get a good night's sleep, you go do your job. There have been times in my career where, you know, you do spend some time at night and, you know, wake up in the middle of the night thinking about all the things that could go wrong. A lot of it is like a rehearsal, right? So if you're going to give a performance, whether it's, you know, playing the piano or giving a speech, you know how in your mind you really rehearse, you know, what you're going to do. And so I in my mind, it's more like that. It's not ever this panic type feeling. It's more my brain is just rehearsing all the things that can go wrong, you know, how I might respond. Is there anything that we haven't thought of yet? That's kind of what it looks like in my head at 4 in the morning.
Those are technical things that could go wrong, but you personally are responsible for making decisions that could impact people's safety, people's lives. I'm assuming billions of dollars worth of equipment. How do you deal with that pressure yourself? And do you have a sort of voice in your head that sometimes tells you that things might go wrong, that you might make the wrong decision?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, how do you deal with it personally? I think everyone's a little bit different. The first part is preparation. You don't really wing it in human spaceflight, right? So on an individual level, as well as your team, but really if we're talking about the individual and myself, you know, you have a responsibility. So you do have to have a lot of personal discipline to be, you know, really over prepared. Requires a lot of communication. So there's a lot of people skills involved in human spaceflight because you can imagine it's a team, right? And something goes wrong and everyone's under pressure and you have to talk about something, you know, very matter-of-factly, as you mentioned earlier, when the consequences of making a mistake, you know, really could be detrimental and even fatal for, you know, your friends who are in the spaceship. And so you do have to really practice your communication. I think our culture, you know, we try to be really hard on ourselves. So we do spend a lot of time talking about, you know, the stuff that went wrong and the things we didn't do well. We always have to remind ourselves to actually, you know, be positive and talk about the positive stuff.
I read somewhere that you've said previously that you almost have to train your brain not to focus on anything trivial or on the minutiae of life. And you have to kind of almost shut things out and be like, no, I can't talk to you now. I can't deal with that right now.
Yeah, I think that, you know, in any really stressful situation, you've only got so much brain power, right? Anybody only has so much brain power and you have to really use it. So it's really a question of focus, you know, and again, anybody can do this, right? You can, you know, sit at your desk and you're supposed to be writing an article because you have a deadline. And, you know, then you can get distracted. Oh, you know, there's my cat, or, oh, I need to pay a bill, or, you know, I need to do a load of laundry. And so really it's all about, again, that discipline to really focus on the critical decision making. The other thing I think is important for us when you talk about technical data is, you know, we have lots of information coming down from the space station as an example. I mean, if you go to the control center and look at the screens, there's just thousands and thousands and thousands of numbers on them. And so the other part of really kind of shutting out all of the things that you don't need is figuring out which information is important. And sometimes that can be really hard. At the beginning of any kind of, you know, failure or issue, you almost have too much information. You know, the alarms go off on board, the crew wakes up, they're talking to you, they're looking at their screens, you see the messages on the ground, you have a bunch of data on your screens, and you know, it's red, it's yellow, it's making noise. And so trying to really quickly find the important pieces of information in that large, you know, body of information is really a skill.
I'm wondering if that ever spills over into your home life. If, like, your husband or your son or your dog comes up at home and you're like, hold on a second, I have not got time for this trivia. Just thinking about how to send someone to the moon here.
So my husband would probably say yes. And I think my friends would probably say yes. You know, it's interesting. What I've learned as I get older is it tracks somewhat with fatigue. And so, you know, as we all get older, we have to be careful to reset as individuals, because when you get too tired, you lose the discipline to really focus on the critical things, right? And so I'd say in my personal life where, you know, I'm resting a little bit, sometimes I do let all the minutia creep in a little more than at work. But there, if we really have to solve a problem, even in my personal life, that, you know, everyone jokes, okay, you're using your flight director voice, you know, right? And so that might be a common phrase that my friends and family say.
I'm sure I get that as well. In fact, my husband's always coming into the room and pulling faces at me and saying, oh my God, you're using your phone voice. In fact, he'll probably be saying, you're using your podcast voice now. So let's rewind a little bit, because I haven't actually asked you how you came to be working at NASA and how you got into space in the first place. Will you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. So, you know, the word we use, or the word I use, is origin story. Everybody kind of has their origin story. Like, I could probably ask you, you know, how'd you end up in your job doing this? But for me, I actually was in elementary, so this is sixth grade, and they used to have us go to the cafeteria and watch the space shuttle launches. And we watched live the Challenger. And of course, it blew up on launch, you know, killing the entire crew on board, right? So I'm kind of at the end of elementary school, sixth grade, you know, watching this happen live. And that really is my origin story. Now, because what it taught me or impressed upon me was, you know, that I really wanted to get involved in space and make sure something like that didn't happen again. Now, sitting right there in that moment, did I have that exact thought? No, right? But it just made this huge impression on me. And so as I went along and really was fascinated with spaceflight and then the human aspect of it, you know, that need and that drive to really try to make things better, right? So my personality, I'm a huge team person. I believe in teams and teamwork and sort of the power of teams. And I also am a fixer. You know, any problem, doesn't matter, space, there is not a problem I cannot solve. You know, that is my mentality, almost to a fault. Like, at some point you should just stop trying, you know, with some problems. So to me, you know, having that event and watching it live, you know, and it's still even hard to talk about today. So what's interesting about my origin story is it's born of a tragedy. When we talk about Artemis, one of the personal drives for me is so that, you know, my son and the generation that's coming up, you know, they see something positive, right? Because if you take people who are older than I am who got into space, their origin story was Apollo. You know, they sat in their parents' living room and watched people land on the moon. And that's why they wanted to believe or get into human spaceflight, why they believed in, you know, that human endeavor as a planet. We have that same drive, my generation, but it's born of a tragedy. And so trying to give the next generation, you know, that positive experience is a huge, you know, personal drive for me.
So just to explain to our listeners, if they don't know, Artemis, tell me if I'm getting this right, has three stages. There's an uncrewed test flight this year, 2021. Then there's a first crewed test flight. And then finally, Artemis 3 in 2024, which will be, as I think at NASA you put it, boots on the moon. Do you ever let yourself visualize that moment when the world is watching and Artemis has landed on the moon and you're all in mission control, jumping up and down and screaming because you've done it?
I actually do. I'm a huge believer in visualization, right, as a motivation tool. I also will let myself visualize, you know, that moment ended going wrong. And again, mostly as a motivation tool, right? Because now I have enough experience where I know what it feels like when it goes right, and I know what it feels like when it goes wrong. And both of those can be used as motivation. You know, we talked about Challenger, but we had Columbia, and I was already working at NASA when Columbia happened. And, you know, I was in mission control when September 11th happened in the U.S. And so, like, there's a lot of moments where you can visualize what it feels like, you know, whether it's a space, you know, tragedy like Columbia or even just a worldwide tragedy. And so along with the positive part, right, and I have been just extremely fortunate to have had, you know, so many positive moments that I can draw from. You know, we also visualize the other side, because that's how you help think through, you know, what you need to go work on in order to not end up on that side of the equation in that visualization and end up in the positive visualization. But I do that a lot, actually. I'm a big believer in that.
What does it feel like when it goes right and when it goes wrong?
So I was, again, fortunate enough to be the NASA flight director for the very first SpaceX Dragon we flew to the space station. So this is 2012. There's no crew in it. It's a cargo vehicle. But it's the first time we had partnered with a commercial company and brought a vehicle to the space station. And so really, you know, a tipping point. And so, you know, how did it feel, right? I think that it was incredibly joyful in a sort of really adrenaline way. You know, I played sports when I was younger, still do a little bit. And so the closest I can come for things that people might, you know, be familiar with is you've won the championship of your sport, you know, whatever that is in high school or in college, or, you know, you think about the Olympic champions and just, you know, you're exhausted, but you also have this just incredible joy that you've worked literally years and years for this accomplishment. You know, when you walk out, you just have this incredible joy. And for us, you know, we want human spaceflight to be relevant to, you know, the entire human race, right? This is an important thing for all of us to do. You also are really tired. You know, once you walk out, you know, you just, wow, I've done this thing. You know, my entire life has been completely focused on this goal for, again, many years, and now you've accomplished it. So there, you also are quite tired. You know, when it goes badly, you know, it's a different feeling. I think for many of us, it's immediately all about what we could have done better. You have that really feeling of having, you know, let people down, you know, let your team down, let NASA down, let the world down. And then after a while, you sort of pick yourself up and go figure out what you can do better the next time, right? You know, you go through that reset and that, you know, we're gonna come back better and stronger. And you have to have that ability to pick yourself up and move forward.
So you did a degree in mechanical engineering and joined NASA as a flight controller in 1998. 20 years later, you became the chief flight director, the first woman to hold that role. That's something I guess you hear quite a lot. But how significant is it to you that you're the first woman in the job?
Yeah, it's more significant to me now probably than when I competed for the job. I have, again, been extremely fortunate that, you know, I've always had a great support system. You know, my parents, you know, are amazing. My family's amazing. And, you know, NASA's really great. So, you know, you work hard, you put yourself in a position, you compete for the job, you win the job. And then afterwards, as people started asking me, I think I began to understand the significance in a way that, you know, sort of living in my small world, just, you know, working hard and doing my job, I didn't really think about or have much exposure to. But now seeing it through the eyes of other people, you know, you asking me this question, as do many others, you realize the value of the position that I have and what it looks like to the world and how, you know, you can represent. Now I have a little boy, and so I'm pretty focused on, you know, making sure that all of the, it's important, not just all of the, you know, little girls of the world from a representation standpoint, but also to the boys of the world. I mean, it's just as important that they see, you know, strong women and realize that that is very normal, right? For everyone. I mean, my son will say, "Hey, my mommy's the chief flight director." And, you know, people think that's awesome, and that's totally normal to him. So that's always a hard one for me, because, you know, most females who've been the first or are in positions like this, I think really just want to be known for working hard and doing their job. But there's an aspect of it that is really important. And even after a couple of years, I'm still not quite sure how to play that role, although I certainly realize now that it's very important.
Well, when you joined NASA in 98, women made up just under a third of the agency's workforce. Today, women make up just over a third of NASA's workforce. Why hasn't the dial moved much in two decades?
Yeah, that's a really fascinating question. You know, I can give you my personal perspective, right? I think that women tend to want to be perfect candidates for anything before they will apply. They're not as willing to just sort of roll the dice and take a chance. That's a little bit more and this is anecdotal, right? I mean, based on me, you know, talking to people who want to, you know, be flight directors, or just who I meet, you know, in the course of going places, they seem to have a little less confidence and a little, you know, about making sure they're qualified, and a little more concern about being qualified. You know, that's been a useful thing for me to notice, because now as I get asked by a lot of females, you know, sort of for counsel, should I apply for this? Should I do this? My answer is always, you know, just give it a shot. And I think I had those people looking back in my life who probably pushed me, you know, when I wasn't quite sure I was ready. Hey, just give it a shot. The other thing I think that is a challenge, and this is from my experience of being a mother, is that that's a really hard balance. And so when you get to the next leadership level, when you're in your 30s, right? I mean, I became the chief in my 40s, but I became a flight director in my 30s. You know, looking at your life and trying to figure out how to balance it is pretty daunting. And unless you have a lot of confidence that the people around you, you know, your boss and the team, are really going to be okay with all of those just sort of crazy things that happen. You know, we get called, you got to go to school, pick up your kid. And really my experience has been that they are, like, my bosses were always okay. But again, there's built into females a little bit, I think, this reticence, right? That it's not, you know, that, okay, well, I can't pick my kid up at 3, but I have to have this job where I'm always at work at 3, and those two things will go together. Therefore, I'm just not going to do that. Now, a lot of those certainly apply for males as well, you know, single fathers and things like that. But for me, I feel like that's a place where I can really, as a leader, help people understand and model to my workforce, you know, that it's okay.
Let's talk about the first woman on the moon, which is pegged for 2024. And NASA has committed that one of the astronauts in that Artemis 3 mission will be a woman. How important is that for you personally? And how important is it that people understand how important it is that a woman be on the moon?
Yeah, I think first of all, going to the moon is just going to be amazing. And there really shouldn't be any difference. You know, when you make up a crew complement, right? Any crew or, you know, any team that you make up, you're trying to put together folks that have strengths and weaknesses and work together and get absolutely, you know, the best skills possible. And so I personally think that any very, very strong team would have, you know, a male complement and a female complement, because different strengths, different personalities. And so that just makes sort of common sense to me that in order to get the best team, you would have, you know, you would have a combination. But that's not always been historically true, right? And so I do think for us as a world to have evolved where, you know, it's just, hey, the best team is going to involve males and females, and here we go, is a really important thing for, you know, the world to understand. And in this particular case, people will be able to see it, like you mentioned earlier, and it will represent the evolution of humanity to just acknowledge that that is really a very, very strong team. So it seems, you know, natural that it's going to involve both females and males. But to actually do it makes a difference, right? You talk about theoretically, but then to actually do it and for everyone to see it, and you've done it and you've made that statement, and then that is forevermore now, you know, the new baseline, I think will be tremendous for the world.
Well, some of us will remember that NASA had to postpone its first all-female spacewalk in 2019 because, and I still can't believe this was the case, there weren't enough spacesuits in the right size. For the women, there was only one medium available. So when it comes to putting the first woman on the moon in 2024, are you coming up against any surprising things like that that maybe just haven't ever been thought about from a woman's perspective?
Yeah, so there's not anything that I am aware of, right? And I actually, you know, had this job when we had that specific spacewalk. I do, you know, the way we put spacesuits up on the space station, it's a long logistics train, right? I mean, we've got to get them up from the ground, and then we use them to do different spacewalks, and then we, you know, take them apart and put them together and change all parts and so on and so forth. And so, you know, for me, there was nothing that was done on purpose that ended up in that configuration. It kind of was an unfortunate thing that happened when we had, you know, two amazing female astronauts on board, and, you know, still from a many, many years before didn't quite have it all set up for them to go out that day. Right. But, you know, we were able to do it another day, and it was amazing. And really, that's kind of how you solve problems. That type of thing happens all the time. It's just that one got a lot of attention, you know, because it was the first one of its kind. And I do think when you consider the moon and how far away, you know, you sort of are from home, right? And how long it takes to get things out there, it's worth learning a lesson from that, maybe more about sort of our forward planning, not to me as much about the specific female aspect of it, because again, that was just that day, and then we went out and did the spacewalk another day.
I mean, what you said before about, you know, it wasn't done on purpose, that's just the spacesuits that were out there. That's sort of always the way, though, isn't it, in traditionally male-dominated industries? You know, I mean, space missions were designed by men for men.
I never actually really thought about it that way. Because, I never really thought about it being designed, you know, by men for men. I don't know. I'd have to go back and ask the Apollo guys. I mean, it was a different world, right? And so the world I live in, you know, we have female flight directors and female astronauts and, you know, in every leadership position, right? I mean, some of our program managers are females. And so I feel like there's a tremendous amount of female influence, certainly at NASA and in human spaceflight, even with our partners outside of NASA. And so, you know, I didn't grow up in a world like that. And that's interesting if there's, you know, sort of vestiges of that's left over. I hope not, but I'll have to think about that and see if I can spot any as I go through my daily work.
I'm interested to hear you talk about the world you live in, because to an outsider like me, it looks like you live in two worlds, essentially, that you're juggling, obviously, your life on Earth, but also thinking constantly about what's happening in space and the moon landings. I mean, do you ever feel like you're living in two worlds and like you almost have a double life?
Yeah, actually, that's another good one, right? This is fun. So a little bit, yeah, it is kind of weird. Now, my husband also does human spaceflight, you know, a little bit differently than me. So our family, I probably don't notice it as much because it's pretty normal to talk about, hey, here was a rocket launch, and hey, this is what happened on the space station, and, you know, hey, this is what, you know, so-and-so said about, you know, a space contract or whatever. I mean, I just think that's very, very normal But I, you know, if you're not married to someone else who does space, then it probably sounds a little bit strange. But yeah, I mean, I could tell you there's like a, we talk about swim lanes. And so imagine, you know, you see people swimming in a pool and each swim lane represents maybe a different set of thoughts. And so I have a swim lane in my head that's always like, what's going on the International Space Station? You know, I have a swim lane in my head that's like, you know, when's the next Zoom meeting for my, you know, 9-year-old? And then I have a swim lane that's when, you know, okay, well, what's my schedule for the day? I don't know. My friends are kind of used to it because I really like this analogy. I'm a double life. I'm going to go tell my son I'm like a, you know, spy or something. I'm leading a double life. But, you know, my phone rings. I mean, we'll be out with people who don't do space and, you know, my phone rings and there's been, you know, sort of extreme examples of like, you know, you get up and you leave dinner, or, you know, wherever, and you have to go to work and you're just apologizing to people. But our community, I mean, we live close to the Johnson Space Center. Everyone kind of knows. Even folks who don't do space, you know, if they know what my job is, you know, it's kind of accepted that you get up and go do whatever you need to. I always thought that was kind of cool, right? I mean, you're doing something relevant with your life, right? And so you do sacrifice in terms of maybe some personal flexibility, but, you know, you also are really trying to do something relevant that helps, you know, the whole human race.
That's interesting what you say about your husband also working in spaceflight. And I believe you did meet at NASA. I mean, is that the case that couples are often drawn together in NASA because it's such an elite and demanding world to work in?
You know, there are a bunch, right? I mean, there are quite a few. But that might be as much, you know, you start as a young professional and like this is the group of folks, you know, that you interact with. But again, you start here as a young professional because you were drawn to it. So, you know, maybe we could ask a psychologist. There's probably something to it. You know, we do spend a lot of time talking about the impact on the families of the work we do, right? And so you do have a group of people whose, you know, spouses. And so if you're a flight director, you know, your spouse works in the industry and they kind of understand right off the bat the sacrifice you're going to have to make. I mean, nights, weekends, holidays, vacations will get canceled, you know, birthday parties. I mean, that doesn't happen every day, but it does happen. And it takes time to learn how to sort of balance and compartmentalize, you know, your family and give them enough attention and then the job. And so when we hire people, we make sure that they understand and that their, you know, their families are supportive of it, right? Because you need that support system. Otherwise it can be detrimental to your family life. So it does make a huge difference. You know, we tend to include and incorporate, you know, the families as much as we can. We're a team here and we're kind of a family here and we have to support each other.
Does that mean you do or you don't want to watch space movies with your family in your time off?
We actually watch space movies. You know, we like space movies. Sometimes we'll get into the, you know, sort of analyzing the, you know, the Hollywood aspects of it. You know, we really enjoy them. We tend to try to watch them with non-space people because that's way more fun, because then they ask you, you know, well, what is it really like? And you can sort of point at the movie and say, hey, that's a pretty good representation. And, you know, like we love The Martian at our house. We love The Martian, you know, and what I love about The Martian is just, you know, Matt Damon's attitude. Like he captured sort of that, you know, whatever it takes, I'm going to fix this problem. I'm going to stay alive. I'm going to get home. And, you know, I was talking earlier about, you know, the sort of the dogged, you know, that diligence, right? And he did a good job of that in the movie, my personal opinion. So
what's at the top of your to-do list at the moment? What are the projects that you are dreaming about?
Oh, well, that's a lot of fun. What are the projects we're dreaming about? So from a work standpoint, you know, we're spending some time thinking about the what we call the surface operations of the moon, you know, which is really cool, right? So we talked about Artemis 1 and Artemis 2, and then Artemis 3 is boots on the moon. You know, but beyond that, right, the goal is to go to the moon sustainably, like to stay, you know, not just go and then come back and then not go again for many years. And so we are spending some time, you know, really thinking about that. It's not too far away, so I don't know that you'd call it a dream, but it is exciting to really consider, okay, we get there, we put boots on the moon, And then, you know, what do we have to build up on the surface in order to, you know, have a sustainable presence? And that's just exciting, right? I mean, you talk about our generation hasn't gone to the moon. Well, then nobody ever has stayed on the moon, you know, with this sustainable footprint. So that is really, really exciting to start thinking through and how to do it. It's probably one of the most fun ones at the moment.
Well, how frustrating do you find it that you are behind the scenes and that you're not actually going to the moon yourself?
I actually am not frustrated at all. I mean, certainly if somebody said, hey, Holly, you know, free ticket to the moon, I'd be like, absolutely, let's go. But, you know, I'm a big believer, like I said before, in teamwork. And so everyone has their strengths and weaknesses and what you can bring to the team. And so, you know, I realized a long time ago that part of my strength is really, you know, here and building the ground team and, you know, taking care of the crew members and really pulling this side of it together so that our folks that are flying, you know, our crew members that are flying are safe and successful. And so I think I know that about myself and I'm okay with that. But at the same time, if somebody said, you know, hey, free ride, we got an extra spot on the rocket to go to the moon, I wouldn't turn it down, but I don't have any, you know, regrets or concerns. I love this part of the equation of spaceflight and hopefully can keep doing it for a long time.
Thank you so much to Holly Ridings for being this week's imposter and leading the most fascinating double life. I love her no-nonsense, just-do-it attitude. If you can apply that to sending people to the moon, you can apply it to anything. And thank you to you, my fellow imposters. I hope you enjoyed listening. If you did, why not share this episode with a friend? And of course, you should follow our podcast on your podcast app so that you don't miss an episode. If you go to telegraph.co.uk/imposters, you can also take out a free 30-day subscription to The Telegraph and enjoy the very best reporting, analysis, and commentary. That's all from me this week. See you next time. Imposters was produced by Maddie Hickish and Theodora Laloudis. Sound mixing was by Elliot Lampett, and it was a Listen Entertainment production for The Telegraph.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.